Here's author, lecturer, and activist Sabina Virgo to introduce our next clip.
The 1979 documentary, produced by Joanna Brock, Out of the Kitchen and Into the Sweatshops, The Story of Working Women in America, profiles such extraordinary women as Mother Jones and Emma Goldman.
The story of working women in America has rarely been included in our history books. We have learned of the male leaders of the past, but do we ever learn about the women who cooked, sewed, fed their families, as well as worked in factories, in the fields? Women helped build this country. They fought in every war. They nursed the sick. They ran the printing presses. They led and aided in the Underground Railroad. They worked 14 hours a day, 6 days a week for a pittance, and braved the wrath of society and the risk of being called either unfeminine or un-American in striking against unfair working conditions. They have been beaten, jailed, and killed in the cause of the labor movement. It was difficult for the working woman in America to get ahead. After a 14-hour day, she usually returned home to a family, which she had to cook and care for. Moreover, she was considered less than a citizen. Yet women have always been a part of the workforce. Black, white, Native American, women have emerged throughout history from the mills and the factories, stores and offices, surmounting incredible obstacles. This, then, is the story of working women in America. The factory system, developed from the invention of the spinning jenny and cotton gin, sealed the fate of the slaves in the South and introduced children and women to the labor force in the North. Young, genteel women were actively recruited as if joining an army. They were assured that they could be saved from idleness and vice by being put to work in the factory. Young women saw working in factories as a chance at independence, and with their wages, they could put their brothers through school, or they could help support their family, supply their husbands with the needed funds for building a home and taking care of the farm. However, during the Depression of 1837, most families lost their lands and their farms, and working women were confined to the factories. In 1845, a remarkable militant, Sarah Bagley, courageously spoke out against inhuman working conditions in a time when no woman spoke out publicly. She created the Female Labor Reform Association and its slogan, "Try Again." Women were among the early leaders of these movements to organize. Mary Harris, who would later be called Mother Jones, was born in Ireland in 1830 and came to America with her father, a railroad construction worker. She later married an iron worker named Jones and had 4 sons. During the yellow fever epidemic of 1867, her husband and children were among its victims. Seeing the lack of concern of the factory owners and mine owners for their employees was perhaps her first step to becoming an organizer.
The sheriff asked, "What are you going to do, Mother?" And I said, "I'm going to close up this mine." And he said, "Are the women going to close it up?" And I said, "Yes, we are going to close it up." So the drivers came along to take the mules to the mines. And I said, when he ordered the boys to take the mules, that the mules would not scab. He had just as well leave them home in the barns, because the mules remembered that Patrick Henry had passed a Declaration of Independence. And the mules were conscious of that. And he had just as well leave them in the barns. But the drivers were ordered to take him away, and I didn't worry then, because I knew they would come back pretty soon. I kept entertaining the sheriff and general manager and deputies, and the mules came back directly without the drivers. Of course we cheered the mules. The strikers down at the mines were driving the miners back who were going to work. We closed those mines in the anthracite.
Her first efforts for organizing came through the Knights of Labor. She was soon becoming a familiar sight at labor rallies and strike barricades. Although sympathetic to all aspects of the labor movement, most of her efforts were on behalf of the miners and their right to join the United Mine Workers Union.
Has anyone ever told you, my children, about the lives you are living here, so that you may understand how it is you pass your days on earth? Have you told each other about it and thought it over among yourselves so that you might imagine a brighter day and begin to bring it to pass? If no one has done so, I will do it for you today. Let us consider this together, for I am one of you and I know what it is to suffer.
The miners needed a union, but they were often too tired and beaten down by their employers to risk organizing. Any attempts to organize were met with brutal opposition. Company guards, thugs, and hired hoodlums were recruited from the big cities to meet any resistance.
Until you get some backbone and stick together and organize against these mine owners, you will never be as valuable to them as those mules they own. And if you're afraid to fight, we'll get the women together to fight for you.
Not only did Mother Jones refuse to be intimidated by such tactics, she developed some very effective ones of her own.
I went to a nearby mining town that was thoroughly organized and asked the women if they would help me get the Coaldale men out. I told them to leave their men at home to take care of the family. I asked them to put on their kitchen clothes and bring mops and brooms with them and a couple of tin pans. We marched over the mountains 15 miles, beating on the tin pans as if they were cymbals. At 3 o'clock in the morning, we met the crack 13 of the militia patrolling the roads to Coaldale. The colonel of the regiment said, "Halt! Move back!" I said, "Colonel, the working men of America will not halt and will not go back. The working man is going forward." They kept us there till daybreak, and when they saw the army of women in kitchen aprons with dishpans and mops, they laughed and let us pass. An army of strong mining women makes a wonderful, spectacular picture. Well, when the miners in the Coaldale camp started to go to work, they were met by the McAdoo women, who were beating on their pans and shouting, "Join the union! Join the union!" They joined. Every last man of them. You make all the fine waists, but you do not wear them. You work hard and are poorly paid, and now you have been forced to strike for better conditions of labor, shorter hours and higher wages. You ought to parade past the shops where you work and up the avenues where the swells who wear the waists you make live. They won't like to see you. They will be afraid of you. You must stick together to win. The boss looks for cheap workers. When the child can do the work cheaper, he displaces the woman. When the woman can do the work cheaper, she displaces the man. But when you are organized, you have something to say about the conditions of labor and your wages. You must stand shoulder to shoulder. The woman must fight in the labor movement beside the man. Every strike that I have ever been in was won by the women.
Just reminds me how what was true then in many ways is really true now. One, that women have always been the backbone of the labor movement, not the leadership, but the backbone. That was true then, and it's still true now. Also, that immigrant women, the role that immigrant women played in the early 1900s is really quite similar to the role that immigrant women are playing now. They have served then and they serve now to radicalize, revitalize, make militant once again a labor movement. One of the most critical areas of organizing in California, in Los Angeles, has been in sweatshops. Sweatshops employ mostly immigrant women. And the fight against those working conditions led by the immigrant women has sparked a national campaign of students and other unions in support of fighting against sweatshop conditions.
And was traditional from the very beginning. I mean, you see it in 1840, in 1814, 1820, 1830, that they were locked into their factories. And they say this is true right from the beginning. It wasn't just a condition of the Triangle Company. Mm-hmm. It was used all the time. You can keep control of your workers. You know where they are, and it keeps them by the work.
And there was all of this fiber and wool on the
dust,
floor. And
fiber,
dust,
wool. It was in wooden floors, wooden walls.
So a spark from one of the machines, right?
Yes,
sort of electrical spark,
apparently.
was probably what happened.
And of course, they also, those places, some of them had gas lights, so it's not, I'm not actually, mm-hmm. It was probably, you know, either very early electricity or gas jet going off.
And so the whole place.
And they were trapped. Well, what happened was the fire, you know, trucks came and their ladders went up to about the sixth floor. The fire, unfortunately, was up on the ninth floor.
I worked on the ninth floor with a lot of youngsters like myself. Our work was not difficult. When the operators were through with sewing shirtwaists, there was a little thread left, and we youngsters would get a little scissors and trim the threads off. And when the inspectors came round, you know what happened? The supervisors made all the children climb into one of those crates that they shipped material in, and they covered us over with finished shirtwaists until the inspectors had left, because, of course, we were too young to be working in the factory legally.
And they were all locked in.
Three stories above,
And some men, and were locked into this room and couldn't get out.
There was no way out. It was either burn or jump.
Mm-hmm. And many women jumped.
Many women jumped. And there's an eyewitness account of a man who said he'd walking down the street and he'd hear this sound, thud, thud, thud. And he looked up and he saw these people flying out the window. And he talks about how strange it was, because you would watch to see these faces that were clustered around the window, and you knew, you know, and you tried to figure out which one was going next, and you realize you'd wait and you'd hear the thud on the sidewalk again. And he talked about seeing, being conscious of weird things like the clothing they wore, and to watch them fly through the air. And it's a disturbing account of that event, because the firemen tried to catch them in blankets, the firemen tried to catch them in canvas things, and the bodies would rip right through and crash to the ground. Something like 147 of them were killed.
The fire was so pivotal in so many people coming forth.
Right. Then we have this famous speech of Rose Schneiderman's about the Triangle Fire.
And which a lot of people really...
Very rich people. Anne Morgan rented the Metropolitan Opera for the evening the city went into deep mourning.
Rose Schneiderman, Triangle Memorial Speech. I would be a traitor to these poor burned bodies if I came here to talk good fellowship. We have tried you, good people of the public, and have found you wanting. The old Inquisition had its rack and its thumb screws and its instruments of torture with iron teeth. We know what these things are today. The iron teeth are our necessities, the thumb screws the high-powered and swift machinery close to which we must work. And the rack is here in the fireproof structures that will destroy us the minute they catch on fire. This is not the first time girls have been burned alive in the city. Each week I must learn of the untimely death of one of my sister workers. Every year thousands of us are maimed. The life of men and women is so cheap, and property is so sacred. There are so many of us for one job, it matters little if 143 of us are burned to death. We tried you, citizens. We are trying you now. And you have a couple of dollars for the sorrowing mothers and daughters and sisters by way of a charity gift. But every time the workers come out in the only way they know how to protest against conditions which are unbearable, the strong hand of the law is allowed to press down heavily upon us. Public officials have only words of warning to us. Warning that we must be intensely orderly and must be intensely peaceable. And they have the workhouse just back of all their warnings. The strong hand of the law beats us back when we rise into the conditions that make life bearable. I can't talk fellowship to you who are gathered here. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from experience it is up to the working people to save themselves. The only way they can save themselves is by a strong working-class movement.
So many of the contributions of women have been either made invisible or limited in their impact. And so to revisit some of these wonderful heroes of history and to be able to hear what they have to teach us and to learn that women have a critical role to play, and not just as the backbone of organizations, but also as the leadership of organizations. And if we look at the world today, we'll see that Unfortunately, the labor movement mirrors the leadership of the world in its gender distribution. And this weakens the entire labor movement when you take out half of the possibilities of creativity and ideas and leadership.
And so one day I sailed away with a heart that was light and sunny. I came to the land of the free. I ask you, is this liberty?
Emma Goldman was a Russian Jewish immigrant who came to America in 1886 at the age of 17. She settled in Rochester with her sister. The repression and poverty she experienced there painfully resembled the ghetto and factory life she had left behind in Tsarist Russia. She obtained work at a clothing factory making overcoats. She worked 10 hours a day and her wages amounted to $2.50 a week, a statistic she would never stop citing. Emma married a Russian immigrant named Jacob Kirshner, but the marriage soon broke up because of differences of opinion.
Linen, linen, miles of linen, stitching, stitching, cutting, pinning, with no end and no beginning, that's the form of the sewing machine. Sewing, sewing, ever sewing, going nowhere, always going, growing older, without growing, that's the song of the sewing machine. Tears, tears, and yet more tears, nights that last a thousand years, heartaches for my souvenirs. What am I doing, and what does it mean?
At the age of 20, Emma came to New York City to embark on her radical career. Her only assets were a bar of $5 and a sewing machine. By taking in piecework, she was able to make enough money to support herself. She became active in the New York anarchist circles, through which she met Alexander Berkman, known as Sasha, who was to become her lifelong friend and co-conspirator. Encouraged by her friends, she began speaking at first in Yiddish and German to small groups of immigrant workers.
Such mich vor die Myrten grünen, gefinds mich dorten mit mein Schatz. Wo Lebenswelten bei Maschinen, dorten ist mein Ruheplatz.
Well then, demonstrate before the palaces of the rich. Demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread. It is your sacred right.
The prison had been the crucible that tested my faith. It had helped me to discover strength in my own being.
In her autobiography, Emma wrote of her first prison term.
The strength to stand alone. The strength to live my life and fight for my ideals against the whole world, if need be. The state of New York could have rendered me no greater service than by sending me to Blackwell's Island Penitentiary.
Oh, what is it I see on their
coming, coming, coming?
Oh, what is it I
see on their
coming,
coming, coming?
What is that I
Emma had mastered English while in prison in 1894 and could now reach thousands of American natives. Moving back and forth across the country, she collected funds and supporters for every movement cause, large or small.
A money for a strike, and she was one of the speakers, and instead of giving it to the
Esther Dogoff, New York City anarchist
organization that should go through 10 different hands, she collected the money for the strike and she gave it to the strikers.
She actually led the strike.
Minnie Liberti, an acquaintance of Emma Goldman.
She, Calatresco, Giovanetti, they were all out there. She was a fighter, boy, but on the picket line. She was the greatest. I really learned a lot from her, too. She's a beautiful lady. After the picket line, they come over here. They had spaghetti and everything. She was a beautiful woman. She would make speeches, fight with the police. I don't know why they didn't arrest her. If it was someone else, they would arrest her in a minute, but they never dared to arrest her. She was just great.
At a time when the lecture circuit was big business, Red Emma, as she was known, became one of the star performers of the continent.
The audience expected considerable of her, because she had a reputation.
Roger Baldwin.
And before she spoke, everybody had some kind of an opinion about her. And when she did speak, whether it was a small group or a large one, she was so positive and so sure of herself and reasonable, always very reasonable, and sometimes humorous. She was what you call hard-hitting.
You can understand Emma Goldman's, you know, total devotion to anarchy, which would allow her to say, you know, the workers must be free to do their own thing. They don't need the guides.
One gift that women could bring and will bring and are bringing to the labor movement is dealing with the labor movement more as a holistic organization. In other words, we don't just live 40 hours a week. We live and we breathe 168 hours a week. And so women have always been concerned with larger social issues of education and childcare and employment. So that were women given their rightful role in the leadership of the labor movement, I think we would see a labor movement that speaks to the wholeness of people, to the community aspects of life, and that a very narrow kind of unionism would not have developed as it has in this nation.